Yes, folks. Welcome to the post game.
Welcome, everybody. Sorry for the delay, you know.
Yeah, put my hair down. Sometimes sorry.
Getting into heavy and heady, you know, breaking down. That's what Matt and I were talking about before. It's a difficult times right now.
Naughty. It's K-N-O-T-T-Y, I think is the way I put it. But yeah, difficult.
Well, just some quick housekeeping. Sorry.
Go ahead.
No. Sorry, man. I was just saying, you know, for folks who are new, because we've got some signups, which we always appreciate, new left reckoners. You can get into the Discord and you can ask questions in the chat there. Sometimes we check the YouTube. I can't see much in the YouTube chat right now, but the Discord is the best way to get your questions in for our Q&A. And also, you can leave us a voicemail. Do you have that number handy, Matt?
I do have that handy-ish. Let me click around.
If you go over to the two, the things at the top, there's a way to put it on the bottom of the screen, actually. Matt took away my privileges here.
1-1-9-4-0.
You can put it on the screen. You press show.
I can put it on screen. It says add.
I'll take you through it later. Just read it out for me.
Yeah.
If you hover over where the numbers are, it will let you. It says show. There'll be an I. But just go to the middle.
I gotta say, I'm not seeing any of that.
No worries. Anyways,
but I can tell you what it is. It's I have it here. It's like one. Oh, there it is. Boom.
So that's
1-940-289-7234.
Always happy to hear from y'all and to give us a break from talking for a second too.
Yeah.
Which is a huge help. I've been losing my voices after these shows, man.
I know. Yeah. You can really feel it going hoarse. And there's been a few times I'm like, am I getting COVID again? And it's like, no, you've been talking all day. I need to just get my disappointment. If there's a little bit of a coldness to me in this post game, it's because I just got delivered the wrong meal.
Matt called the business. He said, you better fire this guy.
I'm just going to not say anything.
And not eat. He's just going to go hungry and starve to death.
I'm going to eat the fries. And maybe
what'd you get?
I got a spicy. They gave me a spicy chicken sandwich. And I wanted just a normal chicken sandwich.
Oh, that's not that bad, Matt.
I know. I'm being a little bit nicer because I ordered two of them. They gave me one and fries.
Oh, that sucks.
So I also ordered a Coke. They gave me this beverage, which I don't know what it is. Maybe a lemonade or I'm not sure what, but it might like be digging into that.
Or is that that might be an Arnold Palmer.
Interesting. Someone ordered that.
Which is half sweet tea, half lemonade. I don't know. The most like just for our own like sanity's sake, just to commiserate, the worst like delivery thing that ever happened to me when I was in New York is like there's a really nice Chinese place that I loved. Me and my girlfriend like had a really long day. It's like, you know what, we're gonna get some good, it was like Sichuan, right? Really good. And like it's nice, but it was a little expensive, you know, like $20 for, you know, one of the main entrees. Is like, you know what, we're gonna get dumplings and all this good ass stuff, and we sit around and we wait for like an hour and 15 minutes and it doesn't show, and then it finally shows up and they had mixed up our order with somebody else's, and what that person had gotten was just, to be no offense y'all, but like the most psychotic order. It was just six huge containers of fried rice, right? Like it was heavy as hell. Like I was like, oh man, like, you know, I got a lot more than I expected, but it's like, yeah, I don't know. And it was just weird. And it was like one of those things. It was like, God, it's too late to like call back or, you know, to have it dealt with. But also, yeah, like, what exactly. The hell
that's my situation.
To do with like enough fried rice to feed like a family of 10. To have those be your problems in life for sure.
Exactly. Yeah, I know that is the issue. Like my biggest problem is that I keep ordering right before like closing time because it closes at 11. I know I've worked at a restaurant. I know what the kitchen's like right before closing time. The movie Waiting with Dane Cook is actually entirely true to life. You basically say fuck you to anybody who shows up. Yeah. At least that's just McDonald's. Maybe the incentives are different in different restaurants. But you know, fast food is fast food, and it's like fuck this person for ordering right now, and I don't care what's in this bag. I don't, you know, just get it out the door. And look, I'll take that. I can accept that. I'm not going to complain. I might try to get a refund on the ordering source. But anyway, let's talk about baseball, shall we?
I mean, I'm happy. I mean, it's been a tough past few months. I mean, it's gotten really terrible now. And, you know, but there is something about that moment in spring when, you know, you can feel the weather start to change and, you know, spring training is just around the corner and soon we're going to be
watching the
bat. Our boys play.
Did you play baseball?
I did play a little bit of baseball. I was a catcher.
Nice. Yeah. Well, that makes sense with your, goalkeeping, but, for baseball for me was the first time I'd like given the, freedom to ride across town with my bike, you know, with the glove on the handlebars and sort of be independent, you know, to get to baseball practice during the summer. So, I mean, I agree. Like it, the smell of the dew on the field anyway. That's all been bought up by capitalists now. Everything you love about that, large parts of it, is all been put to profit seekers, and it's a big problem. The good news is I have a new favorite ESPN journalist that I found out today. His name is Jeff Passan, and this is the opposite of the bumps here. This is the – I want to steer people toward this guy.
It's the stud.
Yeah, exactly. This is the stud. I feel a bit awkward saying that, but I'll go with this because this is a studly first paragraph. Let me just read this. And I'm going to take off the caption there. Major League Baseball is in a crisis of its own making, a self-inflicted wound born of equal parts hubris, short-sightedness, and stubbornness from a class of owners who runs the teams and seemingly have designs on running the game into the ground. Barring a miracle 11th-hour agreement Monday on the new labor deal that ends its lockout of the MLB Players Association, the league has said it will cancel opening day games. That baseball find itself on the precipice of such an ugly denouement is no accident. It is a study in the consequence of bad behavior, of indignities big and small, of abiding by the letter of the law while ignoring its spirit, and worst of all, of alienating those who make the sport great. I believe it was Jeff Passan who made the point, which is that you could, if you got rid of like the 3,000 baseball players and replace them all, you would ruin baseball as a product, right? Like, and no offense, and we'll talk about like the lower levels, which who are as far as replacing like the
of course,
like,
those guys deserve their shot, but no,
and they aren't getting fucked over too. But if you did that, you would ruin the game. As opposed to if you got rid of the owners and replaced them with any fucking random, say, even businessmen, it improved things.
It'd probably get better. Yeah. That's a great point.
And so, I mean, that's where we're at here. The players are angry. Passan continues. The players are angry at the trajectory of negotiations, which have inched along for almost a year with demonstrably little progress. More than that, they're tired of the game they love, they say, in ways both active and passive. I also have this here. This quote from MLB Trade Rumors. This is from earlier in February, but the point is a similar one. Let me put this up. I got to change the tab. This is from MLB Trade Rumors. They write, MLBPA views the proposals thus far made – the Players Association is the MLBPA. The Players Association views the proposals thus far made by Major League Baseball as less favorable to players than were the terms of the 2016-21 CBA. That's an ominous development. The Players Union entered this round of collective bargaining talks less than enamored with that CBA and in search of a few significant changes, i.e. dramatically expanded luxury tax thresholds, a path to free agency after 5 years of service. Like this sort of free agency, right? That means they aren't free, as in like they're constrained by these structural contracts that are they lock these players into these certain clubs, and there's all sorts of incentive to like waste these guys' lives and to save money on the back end. Some of which the Players Association has since stopped pursuing these goals. Nevertheless, it's not particularly surprising to hear of the union's ongoing displeasure with the negotiations, given some players' public comments on the matter. For instance, Giants player representative Austin Slater told Sarah Slusser of the San Francisco Chronicle last week that he considered MLB's most recent economics proposal disingenuous and a smokescreen, although he did characterize that set of talks as more professional than prior meetings have been. And I would just say that is a good – that there's nothing contradictory about that as far as American professionalism is going, as defined by America's capitalists. A disingenuous smokescreen of an economic presentation done up in like nice suits with – I'm sure there's like water bottles on the table and shit like that. Probably very nice, you know, presentation-wise, you know. Good professionalism there, but we know what that is, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and that they're treating these guys who make everything, like, what are the fucking means of production of a fucking baseball game, right? Like, how hard would it be to break free of this is the question I'm curious about. And like, I don't know the logistics mm-hmm. of that, but there's ballparks out there. You could stream them. And like, right. Like who needs these motherfuckers who, you know, have been just, you know, leeching from these players
and from cities,
yes, you know,
localities
exactly.
too.
And you know, there's an old book, there's a, not an old book, but a book that, it's a while, it came out like a decade or so ago, but it's on, Satchel Paige, played in the it broke the color line before Jackie Robinson in Bismarck, North Dakota, playing for a integrated baseball team, and that was at a time when that team was owned by a local businessman who called it like the Churchills or something like that, but in the years running up to that, there were teams owned municipally. Like in even small yep. towns in North Dakota, right? There are mm-hmm. alternative models that made this America's pastime. And this is, we're at a dead end here now, because this isn't serving anybody but the top. And it's screwing over those top players now too, because you have a gap in the lower level players and the top level players. And, you know, part of that is like, and I don't want to emphasize that too much, because the MLB will come in and say, yeah, that's why we want to get rid of the salary, or we want to institute a salary cap, right? I mean, there has to be yeah. some other a structure, because a guy you people should follow if they like sports follows is Dakota Schmidt, at Dakota underscore Schmidt. But it just mentions the problem is like teams' revenue has been going up while the salary for the median player is going down. So you have like these giant contracts, and I'll say like the median MLB player's contract, that's still a decent contract. When you get to the minor league players level, and God bless Bernie Sanders for taking yeah. you know, so much care about this, because they get fucking screwed. Like that housing is a problem for them. They're not mm-hmm. making money enough at all, except unless they're like one of these players who got a good rookie deal. But it's complete brutal gilded like exploitation. The product that you love has been hollowed out and like is run on the worst kind of exploitation. And like, I like it's got to end. And I worry that like, you know, that I don't know how this dynamic works, but like you see players will mention like, well, there's greed, you know, well, they'll admit, they'll go out of their way to admit that there's greed on both sides. And what that tells me is there's a little bit of resentment towards players taking big deals and like that mm-hmm. not being spread out farther along. And like, that's probably why the owners might, and this is just my summation, you know, go to that ESPN writer for somebody who's more informed, but I can't imagine that's helpful in negotiating against the Major League of baseball. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that, I just want to point this out there. Like, full steam ahead with the narrative that this is the owner's fault, yeah. that they're deciding that they need to take more, that you just maintain control over the players. And I mean, it shouldn't be a question for like a leftist, I think, but you know, get out there, participate in this. If you're a baseball fan, you know, now's the time to participate in your sport as somebody who's influencing the ideas that are presented.
Supporting the players and, you know, hopefully advocating for community ownership of these things, because yeah. you know, that really is, it is such a waste, you know, as a culture, like we do dedicate a lot of, time and effort and like social development towards, you know, sports. And I think that's generally a good thing. I like that. But it's frustrating. You see at the very top end, who are the people who end up benefiting the most from it are these kind of asshole owners. Who have no loyalty to the communities or frankly the teams or the history sometimes. of, you know, of the teams that they own, and could so easily be replaced with you know, community ownership. I mean, you know, obviously you'd have people in roles like general manager, but those could be selected in a very different way than just who curries the favor of you know, of some billionaire who wanted to have a plaything because they have too much fucking money.
Yeah, and then now the owners want to put, you know, sponsorships on the players' jerseys and take a cut of that too. And you see that, like, I mean, yeah, I just can't get – it's just really – it's un-American that we
it's
don't –
It's just funny like, that
– Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, like, out of all this, like, the things that, like, the American major, like, leagues and, like, the NFL were the slowest to include, like, jersey sponsorships. You know, and that's sort of been the norm in Europe for a very long time. The Americans have been the ones who have sort of held out on that. It's a little surprising, but I think it's good. I mean, it does suck to see a team's identity be, you know, a big logo for some dumbass brand.
It pisses me off that I have to think of cryptocurrency every time I watch like a motherfucking Lakers game.
And they're getting dumber and dumber, too. So,
yeah.
And, like, I mean, also, like, the minor league stuff is really important, Matt. I mean, like, it also, like, if you think about this as a workers' rights issue, you know, professional sports, particularly professional American sports, are some of the most limited when it comes to your options to sort of, you know, turn your back on a shitty contract or a bad employer, right? I mean, think, you know, we watch some of these sagas and, like, you know, some of these, you know, there are some times when it's like some guy being maybe, you know, spoiled or whatever. But more than anything, like, you are free. You know, in this country, obviously, you know, there's a false freedom to it, but you have the ability to leave a job and go search for another one in your field, typically, right? If you're being treated like shit. It's really hard the way that these contracts are sort of set up in American sports, you know, because, you know, it's like one of the most regulated of the sports compared to, like, for example, what professional soccer is like, you know, that it can be really hard for players to be able to sort of assert their themselves. And when it comes to the minor league too, it's like there's such a drop off between the MLB or, I mean, hell, think about football, right? In the NFL, it's like if you get cut, if you're not, you know, one of these people who ends up being on the final roster, you know, of an NFL team, you're either basically just sort of bouncing around practice squad to practice squad, which is, you know, tough. You know, if you think about it, like, 'cause people, like, if you look at people who are on, like, practice squads in the NFL, they might be on four different teams in a year. You know, can you imagine what that's like for your family? Yeah. Obviously, these people are getting paid, but, like, those guys are making, you know, that's like the $150,000 a year set, you know, not the multimillionaire set. And the fact that there's no other kind of, like, there's not even like a minor league for, really, for football. You can go play in Canada, which, you know how that goes, or Italy, I guess, has a professional league, which I did not know about until the other day. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's just like, it sucks that you don't have that kind of freedom that you do in other fields. And you should take that seriously as a workers' rights issue if you're a fan of these sports.
Yeah. And a really important note is to not be dazzled by the, like, numbers you see about, like, how much a player makes per season. Because playing baseball is not like any job you might have for, like, well, I mean, certain jobs, I guess, have a short span, but professional athletes only earn money for like 8 years if they're fucking super, super lucky. And those minimum contracts are like $300,000, $400,000, $500,000. That doesn't – you don't retire off that. And there's this thing with – and, you know, people might have criticism of Ben Simmons, a baseball player. But I'm, for one, excited that he's a Nets player right now. But a problem that's very interesting to watch there with regards to the player empowerment era is that Ben Simmons, we're at a moment now where players have been paid enough where Ben Simmons ain't going to fucking play and he'll eat that loss because he's already been paid a lot of money. And that's not, that wasn't the case even for, like, I mean, the pre-Kevin Garnett era of NBA basketball. And that's why I'd say minor leaguers are kept in poverty, because that is a spur that is necessary to, like, I think, like, they like that, right? Because otherwise you have guys willing to, like, not, like, walk away, for instance. And it's in a sport like football, like these sports, they can't have players, like, the owners take isn't just because they're greedy. It's that if you start giving players a bigger share, they might only play three seasons and they're out because they don't want to fuck their brains up. And no. I think that that's the sort that needs to be put on the owners, that they, that like they're using that part of society, I think as well.
I totally agree. Yeah. And I mean, of course, solidarity with the players. I mean, these are big disputes, you know, that open up space too, if you're not a sports fan, for people to recognize the potential power within, you know, being in a shared union with your coworkers, coming up against extremely powerful and entrenched interests.
And I almost forgot the worst part of this, which is this, well, not the worst part of this, the thing that really pissed me off to want to talk about this. AP Sports headline, Mets Max Scherzer arrives in a Porsche, joins fellow pitcher Gerrit Cole and other players as union and MLB meet for third straight day in a lockout in an attempt to salvage opening day. Arrives in a Porsche. Max Scherzer, like a star pitcher would arrive in a fucking Porsche. There's only one reason you put that in a headline, and it's to basically do the work of the owners. I mean, just for reference. Yeah. Here's the Mets owner, what his house in Florida. He owns that.
And I'll tell you right now that the pitcher there came about his wealth from much more above water means.
I have seen Max Scherzer pitch in person.
Yeah.
It was one of the greatest Cubs game in history. Bodhi hits a walk-off grand slam. That was not off Max Scherzer, who pitched like eight innings of just he was a fucking beast. You could tell like far away. Like when you see there's certain athletes, if you see them in person, it's like, this is something different. Like the physicality of all professional athletes is pretty amazing. Scherzer is crazy as a pitcher. And yeah, like, what would a Max Scherzer of owning a baseball team even fucking look like? That doesn't exist.
Nobody has ever raised prices on Pepsi's like, you know, like he raised prices on Pepsi's, man. Oh Lord. I know. It's weird. I mean, I'm hoping that, you know, we're starting to hopefully maybe reach some kind of tipping point when it comes to taking care of athletes. I mean, and I'm hoping that the NIL, you know, name, image, and likeness, like, even though it doesn't do everything that we want, at least like allow some people when they're in college to make some money off of, you know, the brand and fame that they're building for the, you know, the universities.
And Strombico makes a good point that I think is worth bringing up. I think we need to be honest about the fact that major league athletes make millions upon millions of dollars and invest those millions upon millions of dollars, their capitalists too. And I think that that was, I mean, very clear when Obama and LeBron had the meeting and decided, you know, we're just going to get together and play basketball. And also how fucking eager so many of them are to join these fucking crypto pump and dump schemes. Darren Fox had one called Swipe the Fox. But you know, my solution for that is like tax them more, and ownership should not be getting that sort of income at all. But I think
you're dealing with these people in different. I mean, I'm just saying, like, people change relations in their life, and like the point of when we're talking about the conflict between players and owners, there's a very clear distinction there. Like A-Rod, for example, you know, player now. I mean, is a big player. He's trying to become an owner.
I think he owns the Timberwolves or part of.
No, I thought he was in Florida, but I could be wrong. What Tampa Bay, whatever they're Stingrays or whatever they're called.
Hey,
he's
a global guy.
Because I'm really making an ass out of myself. talking about things I'm not a super expert in. But wasn't he trying to buy a team and then they made like a because A-Rod's with J-Lo, right? They tried to buy a team and then they were like, but they tried to do it in like a, you know, we need more like POC like team owners.
Oh, Strom's saying the Rays. Oh, they're not the Devil Rays anymore. That's lame.
They were trying to purchase the Mets in 2020. I'm sorry, I can't like do all the research to tell the story properly, but they were trying to buy J-Lo and A-Rod were trying to buy the Mets in 2020, and they couldn't get the deal that they wanted. And then they were like, oh, well, this is like us being discriminated against. And it's like, I don't know.
Well, that explains this headline. Alex Rodriguez is finally about to become an owner, because he became an owner of the Timberwolves. And people ask, like, what's it like to be, have a player as your owner? And to Anthony Edwards. And Anthony Edwards didn't know who Alex Rodriguez was. which is, I think that's funny. It makes me feel old, but it's funny.
Anyway, yeah, I mean, like, you know, these relations, like, they change. And, like, I think that, like, what you were saying too earlier is, like, people are trying to point out some guys driving a Porsche. They're just trying to obscure their relationship between, you know, owners and workers in those situations. And I don't know. I think it's pretty clear which side to stand on.
Yeah.
Obviously, is this like what we're saying to, like, dedicate your DSA chapters, like, organizing down to? I don't know. Maybe Matt is.
Might be good for publicity. I'm all ears. I'm taking that position. Yeah. We need to engage in culture more. So be on the front lines of strike support for the.
you know, but these things, they really do, like, they really do trickle down too, because you know, they're a wage earners, like, you know, like, there are chefs, for example, who make a shitload of money off of being chefs, right? And, like, let's not even get into sponsorships, TV things. I mean, just people who are on the higher end of the restaurant spectrum, they're superstar chefs to make a hell of a lot of money from that labor, right? And then there's line cooks at, you know, the vast majority of places, right? There's spectrums of things, and understanding how those dynamics work and what's expected in terms of compensation and environment for people, it goes all the way down the line. And as Matt was saying earlier, and, like, I know this, you know, from, like, in the minor leagues in soccer, which they call the USL, you know, the working conditions for the vast majority of players who are in the, you know, the bottom end of the spectrum are brutal. And the MLS, which is nowhere near when it comes to compensation, something like the Major League Baseball or NBA or anything like that either. I mean, that's crazy as hell too. I remember, like, in the mid 2000s, like, reading some stories about when Landon Donovan was at the LA Galaxy. You know, Landon, you know, has, like, more money than anybody, you know, and when they would go out to, you know, play New York, Landon would go out with a few of the other more famous and wealthy players. And, you know, they'd go out to fancy dinners in New York City while other players on the team who were making probably closer to, like, maybe $80,000 to $90,000, you know, trying to support an entire family off of that, you know, were doing PB&Js, like, in the hotel. Right. Yeah. And obviously, you know, what I'm saying is, like, these things, there's a lot of downstream effects too in these fights. And, like, that's why what LeBron did was so nasty, in my opinion, because obviously LeBron's taken care of, right? Like, LeBron can get a bad deal and can rightfully be mad about getting a bad deal and being abused through that. Right. Cause he's like, well, you know, I'm a big brand. I bring this much value. I should be paid accordingly. Right. I think that's more than fair. But also, like, he's good. You know, when it comes to, like, the amount of, like, things that you need to accumulate in your life, like, LeBron's set, you know, that doesn't mean him complain about some things is unjustified, but he's set. But what's nasty about LeBron is, like, so then he doesn't have the kind of skin in the game as other people, other than maybe some pride, which is when Obama got LeBron to sort of get the rest of the NBA players to walk away from the strike action. You know, that's some nasty stuff for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. What we need you to do is make sure the playoffs go off in the bubble.
Yeah, man.
Go in that bubble ring and maybe you can catch Kobe. That's what people need from you. Yeah.
How are we doing on voicemails? Just so we have a...
Let's check if there's any new ones.
Yeah, we might have gone through them.
Phones. And do we have any voicemails? Loading up the old.
While you're doing that, we can do our next section. Yeah, but, you know, feel free. I know we have some questions. We'd be happy to take some more.
Oh, yeah, we got a few of them. Nice.
Yeah, you want to do a couple?
Yeah, so let's see where. Let me make sure I. It is the, which March 2nd. Okay, there we go. This one looks like. Oh, we got Dave from Jamaica. This will be good.
Hell yeah.
Oops, I keep adding the wrong one.
Hey, Matt and David, Dave from Jamaica. Thanks for playing that clip of Jeremy Corbyn. He does give an important bit of history. While I guess with hindsight being 2020, we see that maybe Putin might not have been directly motivated by NATO, it doesn't change the truth that NATO is not a force for good in the world in terms of stability. And it also highlights, though, while, as yeah, Putin might not be motivated by NATO, he is a creature of UN, U.S. foreign policy in the terms of usually when the U.S. gets involved, they weaken the left and right-wingers fill the vacuum. And Putin is kind of a direct result of that. So I think people need to keep that in mind also. But yeah, dark times indeed.
Thanks for the call, Dave.
That's good to hear from you, Dave. I mean, I would, I agree with you for the most part. I would say that, like, I think it's fair to say that Putin is not, like, so, for example, solely react, because, like, there was no change on the ground, for example, when it comes to Ukraine and NATO there. There was a refusal on the American side to really continue to talk seriously about that, but certainly, you know, Putin has other ambitions there. But, you know, I can't sit here and I mean, I just don't think that it's the case, for example, that Putin's interest in sort of occupying, you know, if that's his end goal here, occupying and controlling, maybe setting up a puppet government in Ukraine, is not motivated by a kind of recognition that, like, oh, there's only so much time to act before he's not able to act on his, like, desire to come into the country, right? So, like, there's a bit of motivation regarded to NATO there. Am I being clear?
Yeah, I think so.
I'm just saying, like, he's like, it's like, I don't think that, like, I think it's fair to, like, I don't think that it's correct to say that, like, the expansion of NATO is not on Putin's mind when he's thinking about, for example, trying to control and occupy Ukraine, right? Because he sees, you know, his ability to sort of influence other countries in the bloc, in the former bloc, you know, severely diminished, obviously, because of that. And this is sort of like, oh, we'll have the opportunity now, seeing that there is more and more political development. You know, I mean, like, you know, Zelensky and those folks have been asking, you know, pretty explicitly to become NATO members for a while now. You know, so obviously that's something that Putin doesn't want. You know, I think that he wants to, I mean, because it's hard to understand completely, you know, his entire end goal right now. I don't.
And that's why, like, it would be easier. It'd have been clarifying if we had, like, formally backed off and recognized that we should back off publicly the NATO stuff, as opposed to, like, coaxing it. And just because then if he would have did this action anyway, then there's not even that at all to talk about. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it'd just be nice. And, like, I get why people react like, you're not standing up to bully, but it's like, it would be nice if we had a state or, like, a global diplomatic community that was willing to make the first move in this sort of stuff. And mm-hmm. I mean, it's the same thing with the Iran deal, right? Like, we got rid of the fucking Iran deal. We should be making the first, second, and third step to get back into that. And that's the only way to repair that sort of damage. And that's lacking. The desire mm-hmm. for that is, I mean, treated as a threat.
Exactly.
We got another one here, I think. Did I load it up right? I got Kowalski from Nebraska. Going to talk about probably, like, maybe the IPCC report and how we're going to have famine or something. Let's see what Kowalski's got from Nebraska.
How is it going? It is Kowalski from Nebraska. So first and foremost, fuck Elon Musk. I hope the next time he eats fish, he dies. And unless he's willing to do tech support personally on the ground in Ukraine, any good those Starlink systems provide goes solely to the engineers. Anywho, on the agricultural front, if you didn't hear what I had said on Monday on MR, things are not looking particularly good. Ukraine and Russia are fairly large grain exporters, mm-hmm. predominantly to the Middle East and other Mediterranean nations. This could have wide-ranging negative issues pretty much across the board. On a larger scale, and I'm sorry for being the bringer of bad news, but this is going to be the reality, as grain prices continue to rise, it will facilitate the destruction of the Java rainforests, the Amazon rainforests, and the Congo rainforests. Mm. This is essentially what occurred back in 2012 during a super drought that hurt production, and it makes these investments into poor soil more lucrative because the market is there for it. So there is nothing positive that is coming out of this war for
Certainly.
The planet on the agricultural side of things. I wish there was better news than that. And frankly, the markets are all over the place, and they're going to be all over the place until we know what the planting situation is going to be in that entire region of the world, which is a massive breadbasket. Not to be a complete and total downer, but if there is any thin ray of hope shining through this bleak time, I do just want to point out, when economics force innovation to happen during these harsh times, you can get some positive things. Penicillin became widely available because of the massive investments that governments made during the Second World War, which has gone on to save plenty of lives. And during the Second World War, when the government decided that it had to come up with a substitute for rubber, they ended up coming up with synthetic rubbers, which ultimately ended the incredibly brutal and exploitative rubber plantation systems that used to take place. So maybe some good innovations will come out of this. Maybe the Green New Deal becomes more widely accepted as we realize that our dependency on fossil fuels is too big of a risk to maintain. It's not the most optimistic view, but we got to have something in these trying times. Left is best. Peace out.
Thanks for the call, Kowalski.
Yeah, I always appreciate it.
I appreciate the practical advice that Kowalski ends you with. So, you know, maybe we won't get a new penicillin out of this, but hope springs eternal.
That's true.
Okay, got a couple more here.
Should we do the Beto Abbott between, or should we just go through them?
Let's go through them and we'll finish up with Beto and Abbott.
Cool.
Hey, what's up, y'all? My name's Colton. I'm calling from Florida. I had a question regarding bringing up progressive movements in the South, and what you think would really speak to people down here so that we could, you know, be more effective at building them. And I especially wanted to know about the how effective it's been in Texas. Maybe you could speak to that, David, about, what's, I guess, really speaking to people in Texas, and, how y'all are doing building up the movement there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like, this is, my question in the sense that, like, this is the, something I'm thinking about a lot. So I'm happy to tell you where, I've done a couple of like longer talks on this. I gotta say, I did one for DSA International, not the International Committee, but like for DSA Abroad, I think is what it's called. And then I also did one for North Texas DSA. I don't know. I think we put the audio up for patrons somewhere. Anyway, there's like, cause there's two parts of this, right? Is that like the South is like, has a unique history and specific conditions that you have to pay attention to. But I will just say, like, as a general, like, rule, like, the question of how to organize and win is actually, like, sort of the same everywhere, right? It's because we're in the same kind of state of disorganization across the country, right? When it comes to building a strong socialist movement. We're all living in states of extreme alienation and fragmentation. When we talk about the working class in this country, people get all up into a tizzy because that means 10,000 different things to every single person. And the reason you have that is because there's been severe fragmentation, for example, in any kind of class consciousness in this country. And that reflects itself in a lot of different ways. And that's where you're going to really start to see those kind of regional and historical contingencies like really rip open, right? So I say all that to say, like, the main thing, that we have to do is really be looking to where people are you know, congregating and where these kind of organic social formations are existing and try to utilize those and grow out of those in, into a stronger movement. But particularly with the South, I think there's like a couple of like big political lines that I would start with. One, I think one of the most dangerous kind of fantasies and fallacies that you get in particularly states that have, you know, been controlled by the Republican Party for a good amount of time is that we have to go through some kind of, you know, Californication or like New York. I can't think of a terminology for what you would call it, New Yorkification of those states before we can really begin, you know, to seriously build like a workers movement. Right. Mm. I think that that's a real big mistake. Essentially, you know, it's like the job of socialists in the South should be like, you know, fixing the problems of the Democratic Party for the Democratic Party. You know, we are in that difficult situation where like you have to recognize that we're in a conflict with two major political enemies, right? Which is one, you know, the GOP for obvious reasons, and two, the Democratic Party. I mean, look no further than Florida, Georgia, where I see a very worrying trend where they were able to win those two, you know, Senate seats through not radically pursuing more, you know, pro-working class, progressive, building those kind of coalitions that we want to see movements in Georgia. But it was like through focusing on the GOP is not the party of respectable politics. They're kind of dirty and nasty, right? It was a suburban strategy. You can look at the votes. That's what ended up winning were affluent parts of the state of Georgia, that typically vote Republican, that for this one election cycle flipped for Biden and for the two Senate candidates, and then look at the rest of the down ballot, Republican, Republican, Republican. Like the point is like this is also a bad strategy for the Democratic Party because those voters aren't loyal, and it's bad for us in the long term because, well, if the people that they think they need to win over are kind of wealthy white people, that puts us in a pretty severe disadvantage when it comes to policy, right? So we have to be careful about, you know, figuring out what like our immediate steps are, because obviously, like, I mean, like we're talking about Beto and Abbott in a second, but like, obviously, like we need Abbott to go. I mean, he's at this point is an extreme danger to people across Texas. But I also worry what like a Beto Texas, even if he gets his way, will look like for people. I mean, I could only imagine that that would mean more hyper displacement for people in cities like Brownsville and Austin. You know, and a continued sort of, you know, influx of hyper, hyper wealthy people from California, et cetera, into the state, right? That's a dark future too. Right. You know, so that's some of the, you know, the kind of understanding how to deal with the party. And like the last bit is, you know, once you start to build movements that are focused on building class solidarity, you are able to, you know, build coalitions that have the strength and the capacity to work out other kind of tensions that exist within the working class. Look no further than Comrade Adolf Reed, you know, who has just done amazing work, particularly in South Carolina and part in across the South, in trying to build, you know, coalitions, for example, between white and black workers. I don't need to tell people the history in the South to understand why that's a really important dynamic, you know, to work through. And what ends up working is this kind of common recognition, you know, that people have similar interests and they need, you know, to be working with each other, and you're getting people into a room. And that does a lot to actually help begin to, you know, bridge divides that are sort of put on us by, you know, the ruling class in this society. But I'm sure I don't have to tell you too, particularly in states like South Carolina and Florida and Georgia. If you're poor and working class, you probably live in a more diverse neighborhood than a rich person does, and certainly in your state, and also probably, you know, in like cities like New York, you know, so like there's a lot of potential there. You know, so that then, you know, that brings up the last question, which is building up a kind of confidence with folks, that organizing and engaging in politics is a way to change your life for the better. You know, I grew up in, you know, in Austin, but I, you know, I went to high school in South Carolina, and I grew up in a very much mixed race, neighborhood. It was not a mixed income neighborhood. Everybody there was working. Everybody there was struggling. And I've been really amazed, you know, talking to folks who, like, you know, they weren't particularly political, you know, back then. But, you know, you talk to them about things like Medicare for All. You talk to them about all these things. Like, everybody gets it. Everybody wants it. But people don't see it as a viable political option. And, like, we have to find ways to build up our capacity and strength to make that seem true to people. And it is a catch-22, you know, because to convince people, we have to get some people to start to take that leap of faith. But, you know, that's the, you know, we don't get to pick the conditions or the rules of the game. We just have to try to win it.
Right. Yeah. Well said.
Yeah. And also everyone needs to chill out the fuck up, chill the fuck out about guns too. That's the only like really hardcore regional thing. Like that shit needs to stop. Yeah. Particularly Mr. Robert O'Rourke.
Well, speaking of Texas.
Should we do it?
Let's do it.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to show you these because I think it's worth looking at this. I mean, it's now set. You know, not a big surprise to anybody. It's going to be Beto versus Robert O'Rourke. I hate calling him in like – that's such a political creation, by the way.
Right, yeah.
You know, the guy's fucking Irish, you know. it's going to be them too, and – It's going to be very interesting. I mean, it's really worrying because, I mean, one thing that's been so worrying about just what's happened with Abbott, it's not like Abbott comes from some kind of very moderate or in a reasonable position, but he has gone even further to the right over the past year and a half. I think you can't deny it. I mean, this most recent legislative session here was probably the most reactionary of my lifetime, probably the most reactionary since, you know, I don't know, pre-slavery. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, it's hard to pick, but
well, I mean, it is like, you know, I was reading about like type of legislation they put forward in like the Jim Crow South and stuff like that. And like this thing about the trans kids and like, I don't know. And you hear, I think it was Abbott asked about it and he's like, that's like a huge winning issue for us. That was his response.
Oh yeah. No, I'll have some stuff on that. Yeah, I know. I mean, and it's like, and it's really worrying. I mean, I don't have to tell people twice about how serious the assaults on people's, you know, basic human rights here have been. You know, so you want to see him defeated because it just only looks like it's going to get worse. I mean, Abbott handedly won, but had some, you know, of his right wing opponents make some dents into his support, which only encourages Abbott to go further and further to the right.
Right.
Beto, to his credit, I mean, you know, I think the best thing that he's doing is trying to focus on the grid. But I do wonder how much gas is going to be in that. You know, if that's going to be enough of a message to get you all the way to a November election at this point. I mean, it's a long campaign season here. Obviously, you wouldn't want things to have been worse in the most recent winter storm. But the fact that there wasn't another breakdown, again, that doesn't mean that Abbott has done enough or anything like that. But right, you know right. How politics can be. You know, that certainly helps Abbott. And, you know, Beto's just failed presidential run really hurts him. One, because he lost a lot of goodwill with people here. Because it made it seem almost immediately like he wasn't like he built up all this favor with people in the state of Texas. And then he immediately decided he was going to sort of leave to go tour the country. Right. It didn't really make it seem like he was committed.
What I'm forgetting the chronology of Beto. So what was his first? Was it challenging Ted? The first thing on the scene?
I mean, that's not the first thing that he's done. I mean, he was in Congress.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking like, because that was his, yeah, that's
his height, yeah.
Like, that's where he got the attention before and decided, like, I'm born for this. I need to run for president.
And you know, and he ran – his campaign against Ted was unique because it was very much grassroots funded. He wasn't, like, necessarily the number one favorite going into it. And he ran a every county strategy, which was, like, he wasn't just going to hyper-focus on Dallas, Austin, you know, and these big metro areas. He was going to go and talk to everybody, right? You know, and did fairly well for himself. But after that, like, I mean, the presidential run, and in the presidential run, he made a complete flip. I mean, he wanted to be on the hot button. It's funny the things that, like, get him red in the cheeks. Like, he likes to say he's not saying this anymore, by the way. But, you know, he liked on the presidential campaign to say, you know, I'm going to come for your guns.
Can you unsay that in Texas?
You really can't. You can unsay. I mean, but he's been talking about how he, I think, owns guns and, you know, he's all about, you know, yeah. So it's a, yeah, he's waffling a little bit on that. Which I mean, like
take him hunting.
But he's also like, I mean, I don't want to give him too much sympathy, but he is also in between a rock and a hard place because there is a Democratic Party base in this state that I think is frankly delusional about the, you know, some of the realities around them. I mean, like there are people who there are people I meet in Austin and like they might have been here for 5-6 years or something like that, but they don't know any of the towns around here. And man, I'll tell you, like when you come to visit, I'll take you around. Like there's so much to do. And there's so many great people and this is your extended community. And like, there are people who like, they fly in and they fly out, you know? And I think those people are really, they have a lot of sway in, you know, internal Democratic Party politics. But statewide, you know, are a pretty disastrous group of people to try to court. And as you're seeing the Democratic Party really hyperfixate on a certain kind of class of fluid suburban people, it can be quite worrying. Anyway, I mean, most recent polling was like 54% Abbott, 46% Beto, which is not looking good for Robert there. But I just want to put these two ads up to see, just so you can see what we're being inundated with and hear your thoughts, Matt, because Meta ones, let's start with the Beto one and then we'll go to the Abbott one because actually, no, let's do it the other way around. Because I want you to see like the kind of like psychotic chest thumping stuff that we're getting from the Republican Party. I shouldn't even laugh because it's like, it is actually, you know, there's a bit of it that's quite frightening. Let me see. It's probably the most like political we've been on a show in a while too. We're going to, you might have to let it in.
Oh, sorry. I got to play it.
It's no problem.
As your governor, I will continue to secure our border and fight to keep deadly fentanyl off of our streets. I will keep Texas the number one job creator in the country. I will continue to protect your Second Amendment rights. And I will continue to support our law enforcement officers.
Yeah, there's a,
I mean, good dubstep, as still having a moment.
Yes, that is good for the culture. I mean, that's not even the most psychotic, ad that we've gotten, but I mean, you can get the vibe, from it. I mean, it's like military occupation politics, right? Like we need like
drug war.
We need drug war. You know, there's a fight going on in our communities and this guy basically wants to sit out that fight. I mean, you know, it's subtle, right? And it's funny how like, you know, this is an unfortunate kind of Texas thing, how you can make something that is actually so negative in a lot of ways and sort of, you know, in what you're implying there and sort of make it seem positive and sort of upbeat that like, you know, Abbott's out there ready to shoot down the bad guys. But I mean, this is what the modern Republican Party is like seeing as a kind of positive message here, right? Which is quite worrying. And let me show you now what Beto's response is and sort of hear your thoughts. Very different tones in these for sure.
Everywhere I go, I'm struck by how amazing the people of Texas are. Out of so much suffering and tragedy that did not have to be, what so many did in the face of these challenges was to not only help themselves, but also figure out how to help those around them. Out of the example that everyday Texans set, I think we can find a way not only to fix the grid, but to make sure that we get this state on the right track, whether it's making sure that we have healthcare for everybody, or world-class public schools, regardless of your zip code or your income or any other difference between us, or making sure that if you work full-time, you just have to work one job and not two and not three. If right now we come together as Democrats, as Republicans, as independents, as really actually none of those things, but as Texans, as Americans, as human beings, first and foremost, there is no stopping us and what we can do. That's who we are at our best. And it may not be reflected in those who hold the highest offices in the land right now, but I certainly see it in the people that I meet everywhere I go.
You know, what it reminds me of is, are you familiar with the Netflix show Love is Blind? It's a show where these people have these conversations through a wall, and then they're engaged upon when they meet each other. They're basically engaged, and then they have a week or so to, or a couple of weeks to decide if they want to go through with the marriage. And what that's like, that platitude, the way he talks about, the thing I'm struck about when I walk through Texas is how amazing Texans are.
Yeah.
Like that, that sounds to me like a guy who's just been asked by like a mom who's skeptical of him, why do you love my daughter so much? And it just comes up with like,
you know, you're right.
You have to come up with like platitudes. Like, I love her. Like, it's just like, things are so calm when we're around. We just get together so well. Like, it's just, what are you talking about? And like, I will qualify that with saying, I like that he's trying to make the grid thing work. I'm not sure it's going to work, but like, I like that effort in that area. Compared to like other efforts he's made in other areas.
No, I mean, I totally agree with that. I mean, I've said, you know, it needs to be jobs, the grid, jobs, the, I mean, I like the three W's, right? Jesus Christ, it's escaping me right now. But Mike Siegel, and a few other folks have been working on this project. It's like workers, weed, and I can't remember the last W, but, you know, like legalizing weed is something that's extremely popular, bipartisan too. But I think you're hitting on the right point when it comes to him. It's just like, you know, it's just, when I said this when he ran for president, it's like, you know, Beto is one of those people. He's like, he thinks that like what we need is just like a good pep talk.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, God love him for, you know, trying to do something about Abbott, but
like, we sometimes need those, but it's not the main thing we need.
Yeah.
Like, it's good to have pep talkers, but yeah, it's just too much of that.
And obviously this is not the only engagement or the only ad or anything like that. I just picked these two because these both were released today. That's how they're starting it now. Now that it's the beginning of their one-on-one, that's the how they want to position themselves. And again, I mean, that's the thing that's frustrating. I agree with you totally, Matt, that the grid is like, is an angle that I like, from him potentially to use, but I like the way that he does it even is it's so devoid of much other than like, oh, well, because it's like, it's one of those things that you just expect a politician to do, right? Like if something bad happens under the other person's watch, you expect them to be like, oh, that would never happen under my watch. Like, you got to show us something a little bit more. And there's plenty of things that are affecting people right now. And as we saw from, races across the state, like there's appetite for some of these things. And if you really want to talk about bipartisan stuff, you know, getting it more into those bread and butter issues rather than, you know, I mean, what is just having good school? I mean, this is like this boilerplate, like politician speak, we're going to have good schools and electricity.
Yeah. You know what? That's the thing is like, yeah, he talks about the grids thing. Like Joe Biden talks about curing cancer. Like, and it's not roads, like, how are we going to do this?
Yeah.
What was that?
Or the roads.
Well, it's like, what I want from Beto with this is like, what are you doing specifically? And what's it going to mean for people? Are you going to like attack profit seeking in the energy markets and that sort of thing? Like, you're going to cap it. What does it mean? I mean, has he been specific about what he actually plans to do about the grid?
Oh, I mean, he has some plans, but I mean, none of it comes up to close to what we need. I mean, he wants to, I mean, the big thing is that he wants to connect us to the national grid, which again, is good. I don't oppose that.
Right.
But I think that you can make a big mistake. I mean, we need to, to decommodify our electrical market in this state. It's crazy. You have competing sources of energy. You know, you have an internal market that just can go completely haywire. And that's essentially what ended up happening, in the winter storm. in 2020, or Lord in heaven, that was what, 2021 feels so long ago. And you, frankly, what you need to do is you need to expand, publicly owned power, because we have all these competing, if you're in the deregulated parts of the state, I mean, you're completely screwed when it comes down to these things, right? Like there's just some things that you don't even have to be particularly radical about them. I would like to go much further than that, but you should just be able to advocate for. Certainly we need to be weatherizing, the pipelines and things like that. But we won't really get to that until we actually take those facilities under public control. Right. And that's the problem. I mean, they already are getting carve outs to not have to weatherize their facilities, because for them, it's like it's a couple days of lost revenue. And the ability to charge a shitload of money for electricity. Like that's the kind of sin of the profit motive. Anyways, we'll certainly be talking about the race as it goes on. I mean, we've got fucking months. I'm really not looking forward to it now, of watching those two spar. Hopefully, there'll be some positive developments, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I can't see.
We got one final call in under the wire from Strom McCallum, I believe.
Cool.
Strom.
Greetings, comrades. It's Strom McCallum. I just thought I'd call and ask if y'all have checked out Adolf Reed's new book. Also, a question for Matt. Why didn't you just get the damn spicy chicken sandwich to begin with? God damn.
I agree with that.
Because I'm North Dakotan.
Are you that bad with spicy food, though, man? I mean, do you mind telling us where it was from?
Oh, it's from Shake Shack. So I'm sure it's going to be fine.
I don't want to keep you.
I mean, it's cold. I'm not great with spicy. Like, no, it's just never been something I'd like to challenge myself on.
Terrible.
I'm actually like, I'm one of those people who like, I could eat. I don't need much variety on food for the rest of my life, honestly. Eating is something that like I like to do. I like to like put attention to maybe like two or three times a week where I want something good. The rest of the time, I just need some calories. Just give me some calories and keep me going. I don't give a fuck. I'm like the perfect model for the Soylent shit, if that didn't just give you like gas. But anyway, that's it.
I'm actually like getting to the other problem with spicy food. Really, I love spicy food, but I also have like a brain thing. If there's a spicy option, I say yes. You know,
see, no.
And like, I mean, I love it.
If there's not a spicy option, I need to clarify. Like, this isn't spicy, right?
I mean, like, I need it to be. I mean, I need it to be spicy, but like, I don't know. I went out with Ben after his Joe Rogan thing, and we got brunch the next day, and we went to this place, and I got a chicken biscuit. I love chicken biscuit, for breakfast. And they had like a make it spicy thing. And I said, what does that mean? They said, we dunked the chicken in like buffalo sauce. And I love buffalo sauce. I love spicy. And of course I say yes. And it was good. It wasn't too spicy or anything like that. But the whole time I was like, there's like all this other stuff that had like butter on it and things. It's like, the only flavor that I'm getting right now is like the hot sauce, and that's good. But like, and I would prefer it most of the time, but like, I'm actually at a point where like, I need like 15 to 20% of the time to, just enjoy the other flavors that exist. But
that's what that's my problem with spice in general is like, that's why I like there's a place.
No, it enhances the flavor.
No.
Lord.
That Sweet Chick has, I think, some of the best chicken sandwiches on Flatbush Avenue. I mean, they have spicy ones, but their regular one is just a few pickles and the greatest what kind of mustard? I don't know. Delicious mustard and mm-hmm. the chicken. And that's all you need. And it is fucking I should have ordered that instead of this.
Sorry, man.
No, I'm fine. I'll be okay.
Oh, and anyways, Strom's question was if we've read Adolf Reed's book, The South. No, we haven't.
Plan to.
I've been meaning to. I mean, I'd also love to get him on the show. Ben was reading when he was here, said it's really good. Everything I've heard from it has been was a really great introduction, if more than anything, to like Reed's thoughts. I mean, I read a chapter that was published in Harper's, and I thought that was phenomenal. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, Ollie Reed's stuff is that I've read is great. Stir Into the Jug is a very interesting. Have you ever read that?
No, I haven't.
That's where it's the Reed's the Black Myth Leadership class sort of argument. But it is he's a fucking great historian. Like these people are treasures that take this amount of care for these struggles. And absolutely. So we should definitely have them on the show.
All right. Well, let's run through these Q&As really quick. We got three.
Cool.
Edwin, appreciate the question. I might get to the heart of it if you don't mind, though. Edwin's saying they're disappointed with the squeamish left liberals in the media sphere turn into dupes when it comes to supporting NATO. Thanks, y'all, for continuing to have spies through the whole crisis. I appreciate that. Really frustrating talking to these people. We see politics like Marvel movies or don't question other countries' actions create geopolitical situations that can escalate out of their control. We're seeing an atmosphere where even minor liberal criticisms of foreign policy are being treated as treasonous or pro-Russia. Stay safe there, y'all. Extremely dangerous times. Yeah, I appreciate it. I mean, it's been really frightening. I mean, I'm hoping that we're going to be able to break through. And I think the vast majority of people don't share those beliefs, but I don't think the vast majority of people, for example, supported McCarthyism, but that was something that they were able to whip the society into doing. Quagga, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, says, does the seizure of oligarch property serve any purpose to benefiting the average person, or are they almost certainly just going to be a transfer of ownership to a non-Russian oligarch?
Yeah, I think so, probably. As far as like, and this is again in the ideal version where you do these sanctions and they don't have effects on the non-oligarch class. As far as like a non-war measure, I don't know. Like this is the thing. It's like I don't even like talking hypothetically about like whether I support sanctions or whatever. Like I do think it's worthwhile pointing out how invested these sorts of folks are in like political systems around the world and stuff like that. Like it's tough for me to like know exactly how to come down on that. I think it's an open inquiry and I want to find out more.
I mean, I'll say like I support Comrade. Oh, no worries. I was just saying I support Corbyn. When Corbyn was arguing in the UK that they wanted to seize empty apartments in London and use those for social housing, that's something that I certainly supported. And I think that can be, that would be a seizure of like wealthy people's assets, I think could be beneficial. So like the point is like, there's a potential and a model for it. Unfortunately, there's no kind of seizure that I think would be done by the Biden or Johnson administration that would be beneficial to everyday folks. But I make the point, because again, I think it does sort of show the limits of what they're willing to do versus what is possible.
And I'm so sorry, David, but I just caught up with you now on your answer, so I missed that whole thing. But I'll run it back for myself. And
oh, no worries. I literally just said, I remember when Corbyn was saying that they were going to seize empty apartments in London and use those to house people. Like, that's awesome. And that's seizure that you can do. And the point is that they're not the Johnson administration certainly is not, nor would Eric Adams or Biden or any of those folks. But I think the squeamishness that you do see from Boris Johnson, I mean, look how comfortable Boris Johnson was in that clip that Matt played earlier. With like, a very impassioned and human, plea, for you to use your military power as much as we think that wouldn't be a good solution. Boris responds to that, which is much harder to do, I think, than him even entertaining the question of addressing the super wealthy billionaires who reside within London, who have very, very close ties to Putin, right? Notice how squeamish they get about that. It is pretty incredible. And the last line of the night is from our friend from Jamaica. Dave from Jamaica says, Matt, you're right. Never order before closing. Results may fall on the floor a few times. LOL. Yep. When I was with Ben last week, we went out, took him to my local honky tonk, had a great night. But it was like late and we're like, let's go, I want to get something. I needed some food. So we went to a Wendy's. Actually, no, I dropped Ben off. This is just me by myself. I dropped Ben off at his hotel. So I went to a Wendy's, and I know that Wendy's stays open till like 2 or 3. And it was like not that late. It was like maybe 12:45. And I sat at the window for a second. They said something to me I didn't understand. And I started trying to order, and they were like, no more order, no more order, no more order. I'm like, okay. It's like, well, shit, that's sad, whatever. But okay, I guess it's the end of the night. And I drove by, and the lady was just sitting there like this, you know, just arms crossed, just like watching, like just proud as hell after like fending me off without giving me any nuggets. And I will say, personally, I was sad, but I did love her ability to just be done for the day.
I remember, because I used to, like, especially the last year I worked at McDonald's, I was closing every night, like 5 nights a week. And that moment where you have the headphones on and you can be like, nope, sorry. And you wouldn't obviously say that to the people out there. You would say it to the people on the internal intercom, be like, yeah, fuck this person. And then you would turn on the outdoor one and be like, we're sorry, we're done collecting orders for tonight. But it was a great feeling to be like, yeah, motherfucker, I don't need to make you a sandwich.
I'm sure.
anymore.
All right, y'all. Well, I will see y'all next week. Matt will be soaking up the sun. I'm working on some stuff. I don't know exactly what, but I'll have some announcements soon. And Think Tank coming up on Sunday, so don't miss that either. I will be releasing that Sunday afternoon. Take care, everyone.
See you, folks.